Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
There it was, undeniable. Noise. A cough, a voice, a step, a hesitation. That uncategorizable animal knowledge that there's another of the species nearby, and the pause, pregnant, to see if they mean harm. There was a knock at the door. A knock at the door of this house, where no one knew where they were, not even the global positioning system. This house near the ocean, but also lost in farmland, this house of red bricks painted white, the very material the smartest little piggy chose because it would keep him safest. There was a knock at the door.
That was author Ruman Alam, reading from a suspense novel, Leave the World Behind. The book is a provocative thriller about two families forced into a mystery that tackles race, class, consumerism, and our dependence on technology. It's even been optioned by Netflix for a movie adaptation starring Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington. We caught up with Ruman at his home in Brooklyn to talk about why his book is hitting home with so many readers and to have him summarize the enigmatic novel without spoiling anything.
I normally don't care about spoilers in books. Like, I don't think knowing what happens to Emma Bovary changes your experience of reading Madame Bovary, but there is something I want the reader to experience going into this book, a feeling of being destabilized by what the book ends up doing. So usually what I say when I'm asked this question is, Leave the World Behind is a story of a family of four from a nice part of Brooklyn, not unlike where I live. They're a middle-class family. Amanda is an ad executive. Her husband, Clay, is a professor. And they're heading out to Long Island for a week-long vacation with their teenage children. And on the second night of their stay in this house they rented on Airbnb, there is a knock at the door. And they meet an older Black couple who have come saying that this is their house, that they've rented it to them on Airbnb, and that they've fled there because there's been a blackout in New York City. Their cell phones aren't working. The television line doesn't seem to be working. There's no internet service. So no one can really verify what's happening. And from that moment, the book shifts from being a book about a family of four on vacation to being about a book about six people inside of a house trying to figure out what's happening in the world outside. But I wanted to use that space to write a story that seemed to be a story about family life, which I think it is, but was also a story about our politics, our culture, about art, about family, about what's happening in the world, about global climate change, all of these other very big issues. So I wanted to go from the very small microcosm of a family to a very big novel engaged with thinking about what defines contemporary life.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you did, and you did it so very well.
Thank you.
Are there any particular books, writers, or films that influenced Leave the World Behind?
I do think that you're always working with a palette of reference, right? Like, nothing is born in a vacuum. And so when I was thinking about wanting to write a book that contained or deployed the conventions of horror, I had to familiarize myself with those. So I read Pet Sematary by Stephen King. I read a book called I'm Thinking of Ending Things by Ian Reid, which has recently become a film. It's a wonderful book.
Yes, my fellow Canadian. Yeah, it's a great book.
Really wonderful book that really shows how you can artfully use language and, you know, the unexpected to destabilize the reader and to make a point beyond a thrill or a scare, you know? I was thinking a lot about film and drama in particular. I was thinking about Mike Nichols' adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the great Edward Albee play, which is an extraordinary and very atmospheric film about people in this very convivial atmosphere with a sense of menace just below the surface. There's a wonderful film by Michael Haneke called Funny Games, which he made, he remade again an English version of, that's an extraordinary movie about a family on vacation that is interrupted by explosive and unthinkable violence, inexplicable violence. So yeah, I think there was a language of reference that I was thinking about. There's always that particular tension between, you know, art and influence of wanting to sort of know what you're excited by and know what these other masterful artists are doing, but wanting to do your own thing. So trying to learn something from Stephen King, but also not rip Stephen King off, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. One of the most surprising moments I experienced while reading your book is the way you use omniscient narration. Readers know all of the characters' thoughts and feelings. Why did you choose this point of view?
That's a really astute question. The early drafts of this book, the reader is sitting watching these six people try to figure out what's happening. And the reader feels the same sense of frustration as the characters do, because the reader can't make heads or tails of what's happening. And it's as simple as, I mean, the takeaway advice here is to listen to your editor. So my editor said to me, the reader needs to know what the characters don't because it's annoying. At a certain point, the reader is going to demand more. And that was a great note, because I had this tool at my disposal, which is the voice of the book itself. And so the book in subsequent drafts was revised to be told almost from the perspective of God, where the voice of the book is able to tell you what each character is thinking. It's able to tell you when the characters are lying, and it's able to do the thing that the characters can't do, which is move outside the walls of the house. And it can drop hints and suggestions. God, if that's who it is, isn't telling us what's happening in the world. So there's a sense of mystery over the book. Has there been a blackout? Has a war begun? Is this an event like 9/11? The voice of the book declines to clarify that, but it does provide some information. I like to think of it almost like the reader turns into Claire Danes in the TV show Homeland, with her big, you know, sort of like board of papers and trying to connect these complicated dots. But it's actually impossible to, because it doesn't give you enough information to assemble a picture of what might be happening in the world beyond this house. Because I think ultimately that's not interesting. What's interesting is not what this undetermined event is. What's interesting is how these characters are responding to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In your book, Amanda tells her husband, Clay, that he is terrible with faces. I'm curious, is this something you struggle with?
I am terrible with faces. That's a... So one of the funny things about this book that you may notice when I say this is that I don't describe what anyone really looks like. And in part, that's because I don't really see faces well. And my husband, by contrast, is actually like extraordinary with faces. Like, I've had this experience with him so many times where we'll be out at a restaurant and he'll say, oh, do you see that person over there? 6 years ago, they waited on us at when we were buying something at Barney's. Like, it's really, he's like a super recognizer. He's really good at spotting celebrities, and I'm terrible at it. So I am not good with faces. And so in a way that does inform my practice as a writer, I build character using material object or using class cues as opposed to describing a haircut or describing the shape of a face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You wrote Leave the World Behind before the COVID-19 pandemic, but it was published during the pandemic. How do you think that this affects the way readers experience your book?
Well, I mean, hugely, because when I wrote this book in 2019, lay people had never heard of a coronavirus, right? Myself included. Pandemic was not on my mind. Our politics were on our mind, but the pandemic was not. So I thought I had done something very clever, which is to find a metaphor in being trapped inside of a domestic space to describe the condition of being trapped on a planet that we are seemingly committed to destroying, or being trapped inside of a system of government that is clearly not functioning. It seemed like a leap at the time that I was writing it, right? It seemed like an act of imagination. What's happened in the months since is that that has become literalized. Coronavirus has literalized the experience of being trapped, because many of us are staying at home, not sending our children to school, trying to work from home. So we are all starting to chafe a little bit and understanding our own homes as a trap as opposed to a refuge. It's a strange resonance. It's a strange, strange coincidence. There is a reader who will find this uncomfortable to read, given this context. But I hope that there's also a reader who will find it illuminating, that the what the book is doing feels very present because it mirrors the conditions that the reader herself finds herself in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of themes in your novel. You're tackling race, class, consumerism, and ennui. Why was it so important for you to weave all of these themes into your narrative?
It's such a strange situation that is being described in this book. It's such an outsized thing. It goes so quickly from being realist to being surreal and strange and absurd. So it felt important to me to be fixed in the concerns of this particular moment, which to me are, or maybe just the concerns of American life, of consumerism, of technology and our reliance on technology and our sort of our belief that technology and connection will save us. It's like, it's what the book wants to pick at. It's using a very big, absurd scenario to talk about the reality that we actually live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned the theme of technology, and that's also a big theme, too, in terms of how dependent we've become on technology and our phones especially. And once you remove that tech from your characters, it seems like they kind of return to a primal set of instincts.
Yes, and I think that we've all kind of had that weird experience of the frustration of not being able to check your email, or a particular irritation of you're driving somewhere and you lose your GPS service, and then you're like, well, I need to rely on logic or my own grasp of the geography of the world around me. And you can find that muscle a little atrophied. Like, you can make a drive that you make all the time, and your GPS connection breaks, and then you suddenly are like, wait, what exit do I take? Like, how do I do this? Which is extraordinary because I'm only 43 and I can remember an experience of adulthood that was not thus defined. I can remember an experience of adulthood that required writing down which exit you took off of the highway. So in a very short period of time, we have allowed our reality to be redefined by technology. It's a strange thing. It's a really strange thing. And when I think about my own children's experience of the world, it will be very different than my own. I don't know if they'll ever have the skill set of looking at the kind of road atlas you used to have to keep in the glove box and figuring out how to get from this highway to that country road, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was particularly intrigued by this whole idea that once you're stripped of technology, you have so little knowledge about what actually goes on in the world. And that the character of Clay seems to be the spokesman for this theme. He's often doubting himself and questioning why he doesn't know how to do certain things. At times, he seems to feel very emasculated and useless. Why did you want to include this theme?
I mean, in some ways, I think that's how I feel. I think I don't have... I don't have a sense of being able to do anything useful. I could write a book review for you if that's what you needed, but I'm not sure I could repair a washing machine. And last year when I had to repair my washing machine, I had to watch a YouTube video to figure out how to get the hose drain cleared so that the drum would start spinning again. And I could do that. I could go on YouTube and do that and figure out how to do it. And I felt such a sense of accomplishment, but then also so like chastened by my realization that I'd never have been able to puzzle that out. And I understand that, or I poke fun at it in this book as a sort of masculine condition. I don't think it's exclusively the province of men, but I do think that Clay in the book wants to be the dad. He wants to be the hero. He wants to roll his sleeves up and solve the problem. And he has to confront the fact that he actually just can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really bad. I guess that's why I was very intrigued by this theme and really related to Clay, because I'm really bad at fixing things. I'm not good at that, whereas my wife, Catherine, is great at that. Lucky for me. So at one point in the novel, G.H. is told he looks like Denzel Washington. Now, Sam Esmail, the creator of the TV series Mr. Robot, is going to direct a film adaptation of your book starring Julia Roberts as Amanda and Denzel Washington. You made the casting director's job pretty easy with that. Are you making the screenwriter's job easy too, in the sense that are you possibly writing the screenplay?
So Sam is going to write the screenplay, which I think is very exciting. It's in such capable hands there. I'm so curious to know what choice he's going to make with that particular observation inside of the book. When Amanda says that GH looks like Denzel Washington, it will create a strange, like, postmodern problem for Sam to solve in his screenplay. But I think he's such an extraordinary writer. I mean, Mr. Robot is an incredible show. Homecoming, in which he directed Julia Roberts, is just such an incredible work. Really, just Sam's interest in the particular discomfort of contemporary reality is just so, it's just so beautifully, it's, you know, he has a very defined aesthetic interest. And I think this material spoke to him means a great deal to me. And I'm really excited to see what he does with it.
Yeah, me too. So you're not involved with the film in any way.
I trust that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's his problem to solve now.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. Rumen Alam, thank you very much.
Amazing. This was so great. Thank you so much.
Rumen Alam is the author of Leave the World Behind. Find out more about Rumen at wpr.org/beta.
And what Chuck Forrest did is he decided that he thought he could get an advantage by confusing his opponents. And the way he did that was he just jumped all over the board kind of at random.
Author Claire McNear joins us to take us behind the scenes of the world's smartest game show, Jeopardy. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.